copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
And it's a great pleasure to have you with us again, Michael.
Thank you, Lord.
I thought we could divide this into two. One was an introductory conversation between the two of us, and then opening up for all of us to interact. And I think that could be a really good time of exchange, of reflection together. So there are actually three issues I would like to address, Michael.
I'm eager to hear what they are.
Yes. You don't have a clue.
I don't have
no.
a clue.
As you know, when you meet a journalist, you don't know anything, of course. So the first one is concerned with how we understand today's society. You touched on that a number of times. And, you know, how do we understand the public square, the marketplace of our world? How do we relate as Christians to that? Secondly, how do we understand, do we really understand, appreciate the work of journalists and the work of journalism? How could we increase the understanding of that within the church as well? And then thirdly, people in the network work in so many different contexts and ministries. And if you could share some advice in how you see the importance of that, and how encouragement and some reflections on that. So those were the three big surprises.
well, let's begin in reverse order, if we could, then.
Let's begin in reverse order.
Because your third question was about how...
Advising communicators, such as our friends here in the network, what would be your advice to Christians, evangelical Christians in Europe, working in so many diverse settings with media, some with web, some with magazines, some with radio, some with television, some with education, some with media critique, and it may be even some within the mainstream media.
Well, one of the first things I would want to say, Lars, is that my own background is what many of you may also be a part of, which is Reformed Christianity. And one of the aspects of Reformed Christianity, it teaches that all of life is important, and that no vocation... that we all are called to ministry, and ministry is not just preaching. I mean, it's not just being in the pastorate, but in fact, there's the Reformers taught there's no such thing as mundane work, and that everybody's calling, whether it's making shoes or preaching the word, is of equal importance. So one of the first things I'd want to say is that whatever your vocation is, it has meaning, and you can bring glory to God in that vocation. Now, in the world of journalism, I would say one of the most important things for a Christian is that we be Christian. And by that, I mean simply that we be known as people of integrity, of honesty, who report. We don't slant the news to make our case, but we do everything with integrity and honesty so that our fellow journalists who are not believers would say, I may not believe what they believe, but I sure respect that person, because of the kind of person they are. They believe in the truth. They want to get at the truth. They don't slant the news to make a case for their theological views. But in fact, they just report the facts. And you'd be surprised how often that... how rare that is. I mean, I have wonderful Christian friends in the media, and they are really well respected because they are people of integrity and of the truth. And... so in that sense, I just want to say something that's very obvious, which is that we need to be known as people who believe the truth but also practice the truth. We have integrity in what we report, even if it's bad news for us, like church scandals. We have to tell the truth. And of course, you're calling. Well, go ahead.
Yes. In terms of, you mentioned the word calling, and a common friend of ours, Oz Guinness, has one of his books is on the call.
Oz's best book.
That's right. I think so. I think you're right. And if you haven't read that book, The Call by Oz Guinness, it's worth all the time spent on that. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think Oz's definition in that book of calling is calling is the truth that God calls us so decisively to himself that everything we are,
yep.
everything we do, and everything we have is invested with a special devotion, a special dynamism, and a special direction, because it is done as a response to his summons.
Yes, and at least in our context, there's this tendency to exalt the heroes of the faith and not realize that the people who are doing faithful work where they are also heroes of the faith. And oftentimes in our celebrity culture, we have this tendency to elevate certain people who've written best-selling books or are well-known for their ability to communicate the gospel. And I like Oz's book because it says that everybody everywhere can be used of God in ways that we may not even know, they may not know at the time. And in American society, one of our heroes in the Christian community is, of course, William Wilberforce. But I like to downplay the influence of Wilberforce because he's so overplayed. It's like everybody has got to be Wilberforce, where in fact, we all have our callings. And I know two biographers of Wilberforce who I have said to them, did Wilberforce, the man, by the way, in Parliament who helped abolish the slave trade, I said, did Wilberforce know he was Wilberforce? And by that I meant, did he really know that he was a person of world historical change? And both of the biographers said no. He was being faithful in his calling. He had no idea that 100 years later there would be movies made about him and great books written about him, but he was doing what he was called to do. And so, by the way, there's a new book out similar to Oz's now by a man named Michael Horton called Ordinary. And it's a wonderful book because what Professor Horton is recognizing there, again, he's saying, he's making the point about the call to the ordinary Christian life. And he's doing this over against some books in America, which are good books, but it's this tendency for everybody to go live a heroic Christian life. And what Michael Horton is asking is that actually go live an ordinary Christian life where you are, be faithful in your calling, and God may use you in ways that you aren't even aware.
So are you serious? Does it happen that Americans exaggerate?
Now, Americans and especially even Christians.
So if I remember correctly, I think that Ossis has I think both said, Oskinis both said in his book and I think in lectures and presentations on this topic that actually Wilberforce is rather unique case because he knew really, he experienced the impact and implication, consequence, the results in his lifetime, you know, in a way.
Yeah, which is rare.
Which is rare, you know. Yeah. Most of us don't see the results of what we do,
right.
Which I think is such an important thing. It doesn't mean that it's not important to get encouragement
right.
from such a story, but we need to distinguish.
To remember that there may be things we're doing now that won't see fruits until after our children's lifetime.
Has your own concept of understanding of calling changed, you know, related to your own ministry? You know, have you been in different phases?
And only in the sense that when I became a Christian, my first thought was, it was my senior year in high school, was, oh, okay, now I got to go to Bible college. And I'll major in the Bible, and I'll become a pastor. And that was my, I just like, this is what I got to do now. And then I thought, and then I met people who had this other view of calling that said, actually, no, that's a specific call for you if you have it. And so I now been involved in public policy for almost 40 years, and my undergraduate major was psychology, which didn't fit my calling really at all. So to my own view of calling evolved in the sense that I learned this idea, especially from the reformers, that all of life is sacred and that everything that we do is sacred. Mm. And that's really, really important, especially for young Christians to learn, that they don't have to be the next Wilberforce to have significance in people's lives.
That's right. So thinking, you know, of our people here in the network and others attending ELF and the people we serve back home in our own context, it seems to me that we often have a tendency to underemphasize the importance of each one's context, role, yes. potential, influence and what is possible to do through each one of us as ordinary Christians.
Precisely, and that's again why I underline that point, because you know throughout history it's not just been the great names that we know, but the people who actually supported them or around them that had influence on their lives. And so, again, I just want to emphasize this idea that everybody's calling is significant. Mm. And in an age of social media and of the ability for everybody to get on the news, you know, you can be having an influence in the kingdom and no one know about it. But as Oz says in that book, we live before, what's that phrase he uses?
For the audience of one.
The audience of one is a great phrase. Yeah. We live before God and the audience of one, and God will take care of our faithfulness. Mm.
Thank you for sharing. That's a very, you know, it's a very liberating truth.
It's a liberating truth. Mm. It allows us to never to feel insignificant, that every little small thing that we do to even strangers can have huge impact in their lives in ways years later that we didn't know.
Mm. Well, I didn't, plan this to be all about our friend Oz Guinness, but I did.
Yes, Oz, I hope you're watching.
Yeah, that's right. So I did think about another book of his, or when I prepared this, thought about this interview, and that's when he writes about the public, you know, the global public square.
Yeah.
And he talks about the difference between a religious public square, or what he calls a sacred, and the opposite, a naked public square, which is secular. Mm-hmm. And then that the important thing is to strive towards a civil public square, where everyone is allowed to enter into that. And it seems to me that that is a very fruitful way forward. And I think in the previous session here, we heard about Protestant Digital in Spain, and about their wish not to be caught. You know, they don't want to be caught neither in the religious kind of sacred space, nor in the secular perspective. Mm. And it seems to me this must be really relevant, this kind of thinking, to your work in the Faith Angle Forum, it seems to me, where, you know, you draw journalists in, you want to, as you said in a previous session this week, to educate, have the possibility of coming alongside, sharing insights mm-hmm. that they wouldn't be have access to either,
right?
And then helping, you know, contributing to a more constructive public civil discourse. Right. Could you expand on that?
Yes. Well, no. You just summarized it very well, Lars. But what I do, for those of you that weren't at the lecture yesterday about the Faith Angle Forum, is bring together 20 journalists twice a year to a remote spot in Florida to talk about religion and public life. And the idea is that journalists are constantly covering politics and they keep running into the faith angle, meaning they keep running into the fact there are a lot of religious believers involved in public life, running for public office. And so the idea came to us that, well, you know, journalists covering politics need to know something about American evangelical Christianity. They need to know something about the varieties of Islam. They need to do something about when we had a candidate running for president who was a Mormon. And so our idea was just to help them understand these traditions so that when they covered these people, they would do it in a fair and balanced and civil way. Mm-hmm. And so we've been doing this for 15 years, twice a year, and for 2 days. And we get the best scholars on that particular subject in the room. And I moderate the dialogue, and they get to come and ask their honest questions.
And the dialogue is a civil dialogue there?
It's a very civil dialogue. Yes, yeah. The dialogue is civil. Some of the civility is helped by the fact that we're in Miami Beach, Florida, in a very nice location. People sit relaxed in their differences politically. And we get in the room people of all varieties politically, but they sort of let their guard down when they're in a nice, sunny, beautiful hotel.
It's not the worst climate I've heard.
What's that?
It's not the worst climate.
It's a wonderful climate.
Yes.
Right on the water.
Yeah. So in terms of then, you know, I touched at the beginning about the importance of understanding what journalism is all about. Mm-hmm. You know, and it seems to me that that is not an understanding that is really caught by many church leaders, many pastors. They tend to see journalists as enemies.
Right, right.
More than as someone, you know, pursuing independent writing with some certain virtues.
Yes, and see, the wonderful advantage I've had with the Faith Angle Forum is to get to know these journalists personally, not only at the conference, but then after the conference or before the conference and over lunch and on the phone and at various meetings in Washington. And one of the things I've come to sympathize about journalists is that they're all on heavy deadlines all the time. And so they don't really have time to go read the history of something that we all may have studied in seminary or college. They want to know by tomorrow who was somebody. And why would certain Christians follow that line of thinking? And so they, you know, journalists often get criticized for, well, you didn't really go into depth enough. Well, they had a three-hour deadline. And their editor said, I need this story on who are American Protestant fundamentalists and why are they now involved in politics, and I need to know why in 2 hours. And so they'll call you on the phone, and they'll start asking questions. And you could tell they're sitting there just taking notes ferociously, and then they'll say at the end of it, can I quote you on that? And I said, yes, I think so. And so they do. And so they're in a hurry. And so one of the advantages of the faith angle that I think they appreciate is it gives them 2 days of time to slow down, reflect, and to hear a scholar for 2.5 hours on a topic, and they take, you know, 10 pages of notes, and they find out who the best thinkers are in that area and what it all really means, which is, you know, a wonderful benefit to them.
Mm. And you know, having educated journalists for quite some time, I know, you know, their lifestyle is often, you know, rushing in and rushing out.
Yes.
They usually don't have the opportunity because of the deadlines to participate. Yes. But here there's an event going on for an extended period of time where they actually can slow down, as you say, and reflect.
Yes.
Have you actually had responses from the journalists attending, expressing something about that?
Yeah. Oh, yes. We hand out at the end of the conference an evaluation sheet, and we asked only 3 questions. Was this conference beneficial to you?
So should we then address the organizers of the conference and suggest that the evaluation forms here will be only 3 questions?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you why. Again, these are busy journalists. Yeah. They're in a hurry, and, you know, we don't want to give them 12 questions. We give them just 3 questions. Yeah. How did this conference benefit you? Number 2, are there topics you'd like us to take up in the future? And number 3, are there colleagues you'd like to recommend that we invite back? Many of them will say, invite me back. And, oh, by the way, here's my friend. And they don't give us topics that they think we got to cover, and we try to pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. But number 1, though, the first one is, how did this benefit you? And we get some wonderful answers. So I had a chance to think and reflect. I took 12 pages of notes. I now know more about this one topic that I knew nothing about. Mm-hmm. And I know also who to call because of the scholar you had. Mm-hmm. To ask questions about that. I mean, I try to get the best scholars on that particular topic, and it's interesting that the scholars, you know, pay their expenses. I give them an honorarium, and some of them come in
when they get the honorarium after they approve the transcript. Yes,
yeah, they must
that's
approve.
Right. We heard
they
about
must,
that.
We transcribe the conversation. It goes up on our website, but I don't pay the honorarium. This is a very important point. Until after they look at the transcript and approve it. And they say, yes, you can put it up, and then I pay them. I made the mistake of paying people right away, and then they never got back to me, and we took a long time to get the transcript up. But all that to say is that one of the things that happens is that some of the scholars come, and they look around the room, and they see these 20 well-known journalists with bylines they've been reading. They go, my goodness, I get to share my research with some of the best reporters in the country, from The Economist and from The Atlantic Monthly and from Time Magazine and from National Public Radio. And one of them
Washington
said to me,
and
Washington Post
and
New York Times, and one of them said to me, after I invited him and offered him an honorarium, then when I told him who was coming, he said, well, I should be paying you. I almost said, yeah, well, feel free. But,
you know, in terms of the scholars then, you know, have you had any impression of what were their previous experience with journalists before coming there? Did that change their perceptions of journalists, or did that vary from person to person?
No, I think they all kind of came away impressed that the journalists were very smart and they had really curious questions and honest questions. And I mean, some of the journalists are some of the smartest journalists out there, but they have penetrating questions they want answers to. Mm. So, for instance, we've had, you know, sessions on Christianity and science and how to reconcile the two. Not an easy topic. And, you know, I have non-believing journalists who write on science to say, now, wait a minute, let me ask you this. And they go right at it, and they get this wonderful dialogue going. Mm-hmm. And I had an evangelical scientist a year ago from the University of Wisconsin. And one of the non-believing journalists from the New York Times Magazine tweeted out, notice to Nobel Prize Committee, you need to know about the work of Jeffrey Hardin, of evangelical scientist Jeffrey Hardin, H-A-R-D-I-N. And Jeffrey Hardin is a Christian professor at University of Wisconsin who gave this beautiful overview of the different ways Christians look at science in Genesis. And so it wasn't a case, his case, it was...
Here's the overview.
Here's what Kenneth Ham believes. Here's what the intelligent design believes. Here's what, and he just went through and he had slides. And by the end, you know, if you're a journalist, a lot of journalists think, oh, there's the fundamentalist view and there's the liberal view, and there are not any views in between. And they got a real overview of that. And he did it with such winsomeness and, you know, articulateness that it was wonderful. Mm. So I really love. I can say this very much on the record. I love busting their stereotypes. And them knowing they come in and thinking, you can't be that smart and be a conservative Christian. And then they meet somebody like Jeffrey Hardin and they go, wow, what a beautiful, a brilliant man and a beautiful man. I mean, he was so winsome. He was such a sweet, it's on the web. You can look at his topic was a year ago and it was called... The topic I gave him was Christianity and Science, Current Disputes Among the Faithful. And the idea was that there's all these arguments going on among Christians, how to understand Adam, how to understand Genesis, how to understand creation. And my purpose there was to say, I'd seen him do this before, explain to these journalists, there's just not one view here and one view there, but that Christians have different ways of looking at this. And it was wonderfully beneficial.
Well, this is very encouraging to hear. One of the things that you do is, as you said, you just refer to the website with the transcripts and so on. It seems to me that it actually a journalistic virtue, as it were, the transparency of it all. So it's actually sharing then.
The information, yes.
Yes.
And by the way, if you Google Faith Angle Forum, it'll come up. And now there are situations where, you know, subjects are pretty sensitive and the speaker would say, what I'm about to say is off the record. Which usually has something to do with radical Islam, and they're really eager not to have their offices blown up by something they might say that's critical. I said that, I think, on the record, but no, they'll say, I need this off the record. And so our transcriber will stop, and then I'll say, back on the record now, right? And they'll say yes, and then we go. And so, but most all of it is, that happens very rarely. Most all of it is really a dialogue, and back and forth, and people really benefit from seeing not only the presentation, but the questions that are so sharp and penetrating.
And just to finish up this part on journalism and journalists, you know, I read once someone said that there are at least four classical, virtues, traditional virtues in classical journalism, and that is the commitment to truth, commitment to independence, so not others deciding, but having this independent editorial judgment. And then thirdly, commitment to bringing essential things
forward,
forward into the marketplace that actually has something to say in the public debate, contributing something for the citizens of a country or the readership or the within the reach, the limits of its reach, if it's a broadcasting corporation. And then, interesting, fourthly, commitment to human dignity.
Yes.
Because it's actually valuing each individual person. And it seems to me, you know, as a theologian and as a journalism educator for quite some years, people don't appreciate that and how much the Christian faith actually undergirds
the
such
idea
a
of
commitment.
Human dignity.
Virtue.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Has those values, those virtues, been evident? Who's the with the journalist you have been working with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's important for me to remind you that at our sessions, we don't. Every session is not just on how to understand Christianity.
No,
but it's on. We had a session just a month ago, and I think it's on the web now. We just got the transcripts up on
ISIS.
Yes, yeah. It was called the Theology and Ideology of ISIS, and we had a leading expert from Princeton University there, and another colleague. And you know, again, the subject was what we try to do is link what's really in the news now at the intersection of religion and public life with what they're writing about. And so we had this really, you know, depressing discussion of ISIS. But what was interesting about both of the speakers was that they wanted the journalists to know that ISIS is rooted in a theology that they take real seriously. And that was news to the journalists. But so we deal with subjects that are, you know, across the board religious, but oftentimes about evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. So we've had Tim Keller there. We've had Rick Warren there.
Yeah. Yesterday you mentioned about the session with Rick Warren.
Indeed I did, and how it got a little tense.
That's right, that's right.
Rick Warren is the author of this, you know, best-selling book called The Purpose-Driven Life.
Any anecdotes from the Tim Keller session?
Well, let me just first tell you the one about Rick Warren, that if you weren't... Was everybody
I think
there?
Everyone was there, yeah.
So you've already heard that one.
Yeah.
No, the only one about Tim Keller would be that, you know, Tim came down to talk about... I gave him the topic, evangelical Christianity after the Christian right. It was just, we wanted to talk about the state of American evangelical Christianity. And that's what he addressed. And then immediately they all wanted to talk about same-sex marriage. And why do you think about this? And why do you not agree with this? And everybody pressed him on that. And it just went on and on. And Tim was extremely articulate and gracious and sharp. At one point, a well-known journalist on Fox News by the name of Britt Hume, who is a fellow believer, raised his hand and he said, Reverend Keller, it seems to me that everyone else in the room here wants to talk about sex, but I want to ask you, how do you choose hymns in your church? And Tim Keller said, you're serious. He said, yes. How do you him? And so Tim gave this long answer about how they mix contemporary with classical.
Yes.
And
yeah, that's right.
And all these journalists got a lesson on hymn singing from the Redeemer Presbyterian Church pastor.
And of course they have both. They offer contemporary worship, Tim, they offer classic worship, and they offer jazz worship.
Yes.
Which isn't a bad menu to offer to people.
He told the whole menu. And But, you know, Tim was sort of thrown in the midst of this, right in the midst of the American, European conversation about what to do about same-sex marriage. And he just, you know, theologically handled it with such dexterity. And, you know, the pressure was on. Some people would not let go. Even some journalists who called themselves evangelical, one woman called herself an evangelical Christian, and disagreed with him. And finally Tim said, you know, we're just going to have to disagree. Because I read the scriptures differently than you are reading them. And I think I've made my case, and so we're going to have to disagree.
Yeah, yeah. When we visited Biola University, my wife and Morgan and I, in March for fall.
Beautiful campus. Beautiful.
Wonderful campus.
I've been there, yes.
In Southern California. It was actually at the newly established Biola University Center for Christian Thought. There was a conference we left the day before, unfortunately, but it was called Disagree.
How to handle differences.
Yeah. Yes, and how to disagree with civility.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a really key issue. It seems to me something here that you're sharing with us is something that actually is a modeling that, isn't it?
Yes.
So we are grateful for that.
Yeah, I had one of the journalists, a man named Jeffrey Goldberg of the Atlantic Monthly, now called just the Atlantic, which is a well-known popular literary magazine in the States, say at one of the after one of the meetings that we had a woman very much on the left politically, and a man who was very conservative, both asking Rick Warren tough questions. And he said, nowhere else in the world is anybody getting these kind of people together in dialogue with somebody like Rick Warren. He said, this is unique. And I said, Jeff, can I quote you? especially to my donors. But then, you know, we're just not getting together our friends on one side of the political perspective, but we're intentionally inviting diversity so that they can engage each other in civility. And by the way, what I've learned from that is that you really learn a lot, because you get to hear viewpoints that you don't always hear every day, expressed in a real articulate fashion, and somebody from the other side say, that's not at all the way I see it, and you've misrepresented what I think. And they kind of, the dialogue occurs between them. And they like it because, you know, we're all in the habit of just hanging out with the people we agree with all the time.
So it's, you know, learning to listen and learning to articulate other perspectives and viewpoints than the ones we share ourselves, which is part of what we all have to do when we are involved in media, isn't it? We have to sometimes represent viewpoints or introduce people that we don't necessarily agree with, but we want to be fair.
Well, and to listen and then gain respect for positions that you have not ever agreed with, but now can respect, at least understand. I see why now you believe that. Although I don't agree with it, I respect it.
Yeah.
Well, that's an accomplishment.
So I think we're now at the appropriate point to open up for questions, reflections, comments from...
Otherwise, you and I could just keep going.
That's right.
Yes. So let me try to repeat the question, which is simply this. In light of your situation in Serbia, where the media is controlled by not only the government, but it headed up by an Orthodox person of faith, of some kind of faith, Orthodox faith, it really controls what goes out as far as news. And so what would I recommend in light of that to you, and their view, and also one of your points was that they're not really very favorable to evangelicals. But apparently the journalists are not also favorable to the Orthodox Church either. So what to do about that? Well, let me just say, I have absolutely no idea what to do about that. But then to say, however, the way the Faith Angle Forum came into being, and I don't know if this relates to Serbia at all, it was after receiving, as many of you heard yesterday, numerous phone calls from really bright people who really didn't have a clue about religion in general or evangelicals in particular, I realized, you know, we have to help these people understand. And so my colleague and I came up with this idea of hosting luncheons for journalists. And so we would literally, quite literally, send out, you know, from 12 to 2, we're going to have a lunch in our boardroom of our office. And you get a free lunch. We provided a very nice lunch. And from 12 to 12:30, everybody milled around and had a nice catered lunch. Then they would sit down in the boardroom and we'd have a speaker. Always a speaker who we knew they would be interested in hearing on a topic that was relevant because they were working on that in the news. So again, the idea is serving them, not patronizing them and saying you're stupid and biased and we want you to hear the speaker, but instead saying you got a tough job, you're on deadline, and you don't know anything about this religion or this faith. We have the best scholar we can bring into town that can speak about that. And they go, wow, I want to hear that. And I get a free lunch out of it, too. And so we did those luncheons, and it was surprising. We'd get 30 or 40 journalists who show up. And we had a big boardroom at the time, and they would show up, and they got to hear these speakers. And we transcribed those early on. And those then grew into this idea of getting out of Washington to a place. But so in your situation, I don't know what it would be like, but even if you invited five journalists and you had the money to pay for lunch, or start with two, befriend two. But in other words, set up a situation where it would be a learning experience for them, it would help them in their calling and in their work, and then out of that, maybe, you know, more things would grow where they would more fruitfully cover not only your faith, but everybody's. But yours is a unique situation in Serbia, which you know far more than I know very little, and so you might be tough to do. But again, if we can keep in mind this idea of trying to serve, and I think the reason the Faith Angle works is that they realize Michael Cromartie really doesn't have an agenda. I'm not trying to convert them religiously, theologically, or politically to my point of view. And they know what my view is because they do research on you pretty quickly when you get an invitation. They said to one of my funders, early on from the Pew Foundation, did his own survey of some journalists who came before he renewed my grant and called them up and said, so, what do you think? How's it going? And one of them, from a very prominent magazine, said, "We know where Michael's coming from, politically and theologically, and we know he's not trying to capture us into an agenda." And that was a nice compliment, because what it meant was, he says, "We know where he's coming from, and this is not a setup. He's not setting us up for something else." And I was gratified to hear that, because that was my goal. Now, out of that, by the way, friendships develop, and conversations develop, and other things occur. But the agenda, again, is to serve them.
So it's a matter of developing authentic relationships,
yes.
You know, where actually we have something to share here, something that may help you in your work.
And, yes.
And
this is really crucial in America, because we have such a harsh critique, at least in the conservative Protestant world, of journalism and journalists. Understandably, because we've been misrepresented for so long. But it does us no good then to see a us versus them mentality that creates a friction, unnecessary friction. And so we've found, growing out of these meetings, stories have been literally affected, where people felt like, you know, they got us right for a change. They really actually explained who we were. I had another funny anecdote that I didn't tell yesterday that I can now tell today. In the earlier George Bush's father's administration, there was an attorney general by the name of John Ashcroft. And John Ashcroft was the son of an Assemblies of God pastor, Assemblies of God grandfather, and an Assemblies of God great-great-grandfather. And he was the only one who did not go into, quote, the ministry. But instead, John Ashcroft went to the University of Chicago Law School, became a well-known lawyer, and became Attorney General of the United States. And this journalist came to me and said, "I want to take you to lunch. I've been asked by the Washington Post to do a profile, not just of John Ashcroft, but of all his parents and the tradition of the Assemblies of God, Pentecostal tradition. And I want you to tell me everything you know about the Pentecostal Christian tradition." And I said, "I'll meet you for lunch." We went to lunch, and I brought her articles on the histories of the Assembly of God. I gave her some book chapters on the Assemblies of God and of its Pentecostal heritage. And she said, "Thank you. I'll read these before I go. I'm going to spend 2 weeks out there. I'm going to meet the relatives. I'm going to go to the churches." I said, "Nina, you're going to go to an Assembly of God church?" She said, "Oh, yes." I said, "I can't prepare you enough for what you're going to see." And she said, "Oh," she said, you know, "I'm sort of a lapsed Catholic, and I can handle it." And I said, "Well, I just want you to be sure to read these articles before you go to those services." Well, she went. She called me when she got back, and she said, "You didn't prepare me enough." And we went to lunch, and she said, "I was in the back of the church, and people were running down the aisle, being slain in the Spirit, speaking in tongues, and prophesying." It was just scared her. But, truth be told, she wrote a long piece in the Washington Post, what we call the style section, section C, cover story, and she got John Ashcroft's family, his lineage right, and people who read it said, "Wow, she didn't use it as the occasion to attack the Assemblies of God, but simply to explain the tradition." And this was a wonderful example of a reporter saying, "I want my readers to know where he's coming from." And didn't do it in a cynical way, didn't do it in a sarcastic way, but just told the story. But was a little shaken up by some of the source of services.
Great.
Other questions? And so, of course, the question is simply, in light of the... In the UK, there's been some controversy about unethical journalism. Same is true in America. And the question is, do I have any comment about this ongoing trend of unethical practice in journalism? And the only thing I would say simply is that the challenge for journalism, as you well know now, because of the internet and because of social media and because of the rapid news, the temptation for unethical journalism is much higher, because everybody is scooping everybody all the time, or pretending to. And so where you could sort of plod along and say, you know, I have a deadline at 6 tonight, which gives me 7 hours to work on a story, it's more like the news cycle's constantly going. And so a journalist friend of mine saying, you know, the pressure is so great to to not be patient to get the story right. And so sometimes the unethical practices grow out of just that huge pressure to beat the opposition. Now, wonderful thing about the internet and social media is when it happens, it gets self-corrected immediately. You were unethical on this, and we caught you, and we're going to let everybody know through the Drudge Report that everything you said was a lie. And so, ironically, the unethical practices are then caught quickly and then immediately nailed. And that's always refreshing to see. You know, some well-known journalists who thought they could get away. They can't get away. Well, I will give you a perfect example. Brian Williams of NBC News in America. You may not have known. But this is a well-known evening news broadcaster. Long-time experience at NBC News. Turns out that he had exaggerated several stories about his coverage of the war in Iraq and said, you know, we went down with the plane and we were... Well, actually turned out he wasn't there. And this has happened about 4 or 5 months ago. And he kept talking about how he was there when it happened. And some Marines that were there came out after he'd done this 3 or 4 times publicly and publicly said, you know, Brian Williams was not there. And it was like, and we know because we were there. And we're tired of him constantly saying he was somewhere where he wasn't in a very dangerous situation. Now, hey, why would Brian Williams do that? He's trying to let people, he's again tempted to say, I'm actually closer to the scene than I was. And everybody goes, oh, wow, you're so impressive. Well, it turns out he wasn't. What happened to Brian Williams? He was put on leave for 9 or 10 months. And the question, NBC, biggest name at NBC News in New York, and the question is now, will Brian Williams survive? Because it turns out this is one of the only thing that he embellished and exaggerated. And they went back and looked at other things he'd done. Well, so there's a situation where somebody was unethical, embellishing, but it was caught because of, again, the ability of the news cycle for people to say, you know, you should quit telling that story because we know it's not true. And here's a guy who gets, you know, $20 million a year, and he's probably not going to survive at NBC News. I mean, there's speculation of, you know, can his reputation be recovered? So to answer your question, they're more unethical practices, but a lot of them are getting caught too. Well, you know, let me repeat the question for the tape, which is simply that I had mentioned that the Faith Angle Forum, which is now twice a year in the U.S., would it ever expand to Europe? And it would only expand to Europe if some wonderfully generous donor said, expand to Europe, and here's the money. But we had, as I mentioned yesterday, a year and a half ago, a whole 2.5-hour session on who is Pope Francis. And one of the speakers was from the UK, John Valery, who'd written a biography of Francis. And he was just in awe of the whole event. He just kept saying, we don't have this in the UK. We don't have this in Europe. I'm talking to all these journalists about a subject I know very well, and we need to have this in Europe. And I had two observers at the conference. I have 20 journalists, and I have what are called observers. What are observers? Those are funders, who are either potential funders or people who've given, and they are allowed to come and listen in. And two of the observers from a well-known foundation called the Templeton Foundation in Philadelphia. And I said to John Valley, you need to talk to the folks from Templeton about that. And he did. And he emailed me and said, we wanted this to happen. But it's been slow in coming because some of these funders are slow in moving. But we've quite literally looked into potential places to have such events. So we would be glad to do it if the funding is there. And what would we do? We would invite, I think the way to do it would be to invite 4, 5, or 6 of our U.S. participants who are veterans at ours to come along with us and invite, you know, 14 or 15 European journalists, not only from the U.K., but Scotland and Germany and elsewhere, and hold it again at a... Again, one of the keys to the Faith Angle is that we don't hold it in Washington, D.C., We try to go to a location that makes them stop what they're doing and settle down for 2 days. And so if we did it in Europe, you know, the idea would be to go, you know, on the coast of somewhere that it would be a draw. You know, some journalist who gets an email from me inviting them, they go, who is he? And what is this all about? It's a setup. But if I say I'm inviting you to the coast of France for 2 days to talk about... Again, now, the topics we would choose there would be topics relevant to European journalists on the intersection of religion and public life. We try very hard to make the topics that are not just of interest to us, but of interest to what they're working on, so that when they go back, so we would actually consult with our European journalist friends about what are the issues that are really a moment. At our last Faith Angle Forum, we always, he's come more than two or three times, the Washington editor of The Economist comes to almost every one of them, David Rennie. And, you know, David would know all the Economist writers at his headquarters in London, and he would know journalists in Europe. And, you know, so we would consult with people like that. But again, I say for the tape and for the public, if you're there and you feel so moved and you're worth several millions of dollars and you would like to contribute to the Faith Angle European project, we're certainly open to it.
Message given and received.
Message received, yes. Yeah, there'd be quite the strategic question would be, should the invitation come just from us, or should we link it with someone else that they would be familiar with there, and that would just be a kind of a prudential question to decide upon.
You know, something we touched on yesterday, or maybe the day before, I can't remember, in our session together with the Politics and Society Network, the first session yesterday was.
Yes.
was that, you know, we all at European Leadership Forum, we have a shared commitment to evangelical theology. And I think it's, even though our contexts are different in Europe, you know, we talked about that in a number of sessions, also in last session, about the difference from the Southern European context, the Eastern European context, the UK context, the Northern Scandinavian context, and the German, and so on. But I think one thing that is in common is that often, whether evangelical Christianity historically has been part of the mainline churches and mainline culture, or whether it has been a minority position, nowadays we often get the public perception is influenced by what's happening in the US.
Mm.
So I think that's something that is often difficult to get around. The fact that people, you know, associate us with what's the public perception of evangelicalism.
Yes, okay.
And, you know, sometimes it's not fair at all. Sometimes it's elements of truth, it seems, but it's not necessarily. So have you reflected or been thinking about, you know, because this is part of what you're actually battling at home, you know, trying to do something about that for the U.S. scene.
Yeah.
But this, I think, is a larger issue, in fact, beyond the U.S., because, as I said, it's a public perception there that is difficult to get around, it seems to me.
Yes, although I would say that... speaking as American, we often think of how much we've been influenced by European evangelical thinking. So we all read John Stott, we all read J.I. Packer, we all read N.T. Wright, we all read your best theologians, and think that when people ask us, you know, who are your theological stars, we start naming people from England and Scotland so often, it seems like. But what's interesting about journalists is, though, I cannot tell you how many times during the George W. Bush administration I had phone calls from European journalists from either the BBC or elsewhere who would say, so isn't it, you're the director of the Evangelical Studies Program at your think tank. George W. Bush is an evangelical Christian. Isn't his policy in the Middle East rooted in an evangelical end times eschatology? For instance, they would say one of the best-selling books in America is a book by Tim and Beverly LeHay, these novels that are just, I'll say for the record, awful novels, really bad, both literarily and theologically, but they've sold 40 million copies. And literally one BBC reporter said, you know, aren't they influenced by eschatology and the Tim LeHay novels? And I said, I assure you that Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, does not read Tim LeHay novels. And that their policies in the Middle East is, the word end times doesn't come up in cabinet meetings when it comes to the Middle East. And they go, are you sure? And I said, because a person has a personal faith about God's grace and forgiveness working in their life, doesn't mean that when they go into policy meetings, they look at the book of Revelation for guidance. You may think they do that. I'm telling you, I know people in the White House, and that's not what they talk about. So, you know, I was given the opportunity to disabuse them of this quick thing of he's an evangelical, that means his theology, his politics are driven by this eschatology. And I had to thwart that view so many times. Of European writers who would think he's driven by an end-time scenario. And by the way, it was fun in my position to do that. It was I enjoyed being, you know, you're going in the wrong direction. It's not, you may disagree with this Middle East policy, but I promise it's not rooted in Old Testament and New Testament prophecies. But to your question, though, is we often feel like we're influenced by some of your best. I wasn't aware that you all often were branded with some of the excesses of American evangelicalism.
I think that's true, though. For you may, you know, affirm if that is true from your perspective.
Well, I bring my deepest apologies. So if I could just repeat your observation, which is simply that you had a Spanish network do a whole. You said how many months they spend in the U.S.?
3 months.
3 months on, quote, the American...
A news network, yeah.
A news network on American Jesus. And they picked the worst excesses of what could really be called American fundamentalism or parts of Pentecostalism and said, this is American evangelicalism, ladies and gentlemen. I want to introduce my readers and viewers in Spain. This is American evangelicalism. And it's just so... It so grieves all of us when that happens. Because it's so unfortunate, and it's absolutely, they picked the worst and most minority part of Christendom. I mean, the snake handlers in the United States of America, they're this many left. And even American fundamentalism is dying, because a lot of American fundamentalists are becoming American evangelicals, quite literally. They see how fundamentalism has often been legalistic and harsh and unloving and uncharitable, and they've joined large word of American evangelicalism. But we had maybe 10 years ago, the wonderful American evangelical historian Mark Knoll at the Faith Angle. And his talk was entitled Understanding American Evangelicalism. And he did something very wonderful there. He talked about the history of American evangelicalism from Europe and into the United States. And then he talked about what he called evangelicalism at its best and evangelicalism at its worst. And he gave examples of heroes of the faith, from Lord Shaftesbury to Wilberforce to others, and gave examples of their exemplary Christian life. Hmm. And then he gave examples of eccentric evangelical preachers that we all would agree not very helpful. And he said, it's important for you as journalists to understand the best and worst of any tradition. And it's important that when you go cover it, don't go looking for the worst of the tradition and say that's the tradition. But actually understand that these traditions have their best elements and then they have their eccentric parts. And that was just so helpful. Don't go just looking for the wackos who claim our faith, but go looking for the best exemplaries of that faith. And by the way, I think when they heard Rick Warren, they realized, oh, this guy's actually a wonderfully gentle, sweet, decent, kind person. And the same with Tim Keller. And so, it breaks their stereotypes and their preconceived notions that they literally had that some, you know, that all evangelicals are snake handlers. It's not true.
Seems like a good portion of biblical realism about humans, sir. You know, we all tend to make that mistake of stereotyping. And when that is taken to its extreme, then it's really very harmful.
Right. And so I should repeat the question. What about the situation now in the American elections coming up in over a year from now, where on the Republican side, a few of the candidates are actually one's a former preacher and some are evangelicals by faith? Let me just say right away, so that's the question. What can I tell you about that? Let me first of all say that being a regenerated evangelical Christian does not guarantee political wisdom, period. And for any evangelical that thinks, I'll vote for him or her because he's of my faith, is being imprudent, unwise, and thoughtless. As a lot of evangelicals, I would never vote for. And they actually think that I should because they are. And right now, some of the ones that are evangelical candidates in the last week while I've been here have made other fools of themselves by public statements they've made that should eliminate them from their candidacy. I speak of, do I need to name names? Governor Mike Huckabee has just made some really stupid comments about a sexual scandal that we had recently last week in among American evangelicals. And he's been critiqued hard for it. And so in that sense, see, there's a sense where, but there are others who claim faith. By the way, in America, if you're running for president, a colleague of mine says, anybody who begins running for president, they start attending church right away. Because it's true in America that you simply won't win. And all polls say most Americans want their president to be a person of faith. You don't care what kind of faith, but of faith. 78% of Americans say that in polling data. Yes, you have a follow-up question. Are you asking me also to make predictions about what's going to happen in the election? Kind of, what are the predictions? Right now, on the Democratic side, we have a woman named Hillary Clinton who's running for president. And she is...
2 billion
yes. They. You know, since I've been here, I've been keeping up a little bit through the Internet. Her poll numbers are really not good right now. I mean, they've actually been dipping down, way down, because of the constant drip, drip, drip of scandals with the Clinton Foundation. And when she was in the State Department as Secretary of State, you know, money going to the Clinton Foundation, well, that all looks pretty shaky. And if I was working for her, I'd be really nervous right now about these poll numbers of people who don't trust her. So now there's a few other candidates in the Democratic Party that are announcing, and it remains to be seen. Now, on the Republican side, we've got, you know, maybe 20 candidates. And somebody every day says, I'm running too. And why don't everybody just jump in the pool? And one of the debates is, and the debates comes up, you know, how many people can we have on the stage? You know, they're trying to limit it to 10, and we got about 16 candidates. These things have a way of, you know, weeding themselves out. And now, for journalists, both on the European side and the American side, you know, again, the faith angle question will come up, because some of these candidates will want to say, I'm more religious than any of the other candidates. And they will report on that. But at the end of the day, it won't come down to their faith commitment. It'll come down to what their policies are and whether Americans really feel their economics or their foreign policy fits with what they think is important for the U.S. at this time. And, you know, candidates who overstate their religious beliefs and wear it on their sleeve run the risk of coming across as sanctimonious and self-righteous. And they have to be careful. At the same time, it's also the case in America, all the polling data says if you're an atheist, you're just never going to be president of the United States. And I've been on panels with atheists who say, well, I don't think that's fair. I said, I didn't say it. It's the poll numbers say it. The polls say 92% of America will not ever vote for an atheist. Now, that's interesting, but it's just the facts. And I have been in situations with atheists. Well, that's just not right. Well, tell the American people. They don't. For some reason, because of America's religious past, they want their leaders, at the end of the day, have an external reference point when decisions of war and peace come to mind. They want to know, does this person reference something other than themselves when these big kind of decisions are made? And that's just the reality. Now, we will do a faith angle, by the way, I'm sure, as the election comes up. Yeah. And we'll bring in a political demographer to tell people, this is how Catholics will vote. This is how evangelicals will vote. This is how... We have actually done this in the past, where we have people who do survey data, and they can tell who's the most appealing candidate for these groups. And as a result, it's really illuminating to see. For instance, in the last election, more evangelicals voted for the Mormon Mitt Romney than Mormons voted for Mitt Romney. Now, isn't that interesting? Oh, it was only by 1%. 79% of evangelicals voted for a member of the LDS Church, and 78% of Mormons voted for Mitt Romney. Now, the speculation running up into that was evangelicals will not vote for a member of the Mormon Church. Well, actually, no, that's not true, because evangelicals largely have come to the belief that when you're voting for a candidate for president, you're not voting for pastor-in-chief, you're voting for commander-in-chief. And so they bracket aside the theological differences and look at the man and his policies and his family and his moral positions and say, you know, those resonate with mine. And we'll have a discussion about our disagreements on theology after he's elected president. But we want him to be the president. And that's where they kind of came to, which is interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting. And I think that also shows some of the, you know, one of the, what is still a huge difference between U.S. and Europe at large, what you just shared. So thank you for sharing that. It's really, I think, stimulating for us to understand that perspective. It's important for us as well to try to understand what's happening across the ocean.
Across the pond.
That's right, across the pond.
Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, good.
So we are actually...
running out of time, aren't we?
No, not out of time, but we're running towards the end of time. Not the end times, maybe, because they are probably already here, I think. Just to sum up, you know, remember we had in the first session, we talked about that we in this network wanted to have a broad range of themes and topics that we addressed, because we all represent a broad spectrum of contexts and callings. We've touched on callings here. And I do hope that this has been a profitable time for each one of us, and that we get to, you know, come away with some sense of encouragement, and you know, Joel sharing the fact that a year ago it was an idea, a vision, now it's a reality. And this is, in fact, you know, maybe true for so many of the things we're involved in.
Before you conclude, can I make one more comment?
Please do.
In conclusion, which is simply this, that one of the things I've learned through the faith angle that I didn't emphasize, which is that, and we have a lot of seminars here on apologetics, the best apologetic is a friendship. Mm. The best apologetic is a Christian life well lived in friendship with people who are not believers. And one of the best witnesses to this is one of the journalists who came to my recent faith angle, a woman who wrote about 5 months ago on the web why I've decided to come out as a Christian. Her name is Anna. She used to be write a column in Washington. It was snarky, it was cynical, it was snarky and cynical. And all of a sudden I saw this by her and I thought, and I read it. You know what she says? And you can Google the phrase, why I decided to come out as a Christian. It was friends who she said, you know, I don't understand your life. Explain to me your peace, your joy, your contentment. And it was the witness of friends who then proceeded to answer questions that she had that led her to the faith.
Wonderful.
And I read that and I said, we got to invite her to the next faith thing when she came. And I never forget when she came in the hotel, I said, welcome to the family. So I just underline that point that if you can't duplicate the faith angle, you can still have friendships. And
that's,
I think,
right,
one of the best apologetics is, over time, a friendship that's welcoming and charitable is the best witness.
Yeah, so would you like to close in prayer for us, Michael?
Yes, sure. But before I close in prayer, I would ask you to remember to pray for us and the faith angle forum for the friendships and for the thing and the conversations that grow out of those friendships, organically, unforced, but authentic. So and as we leave in the days ahead, in the months ahead, remember us every time you look at that website to pray for us.
Yeah.
So in closing, let me pray. Yeah. God our Father, thank you for your mercy, your grace, your loving kindness, and your work in each of our lives. We pray that as we go forward, you continue to show us your glory. And we'll give you the praise in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen.